so I didn't put a stamp on it. That's the government expense. They paid the postage for the card, and they're upset. A Christmas card depicting a seriously wounded soldier receiving plasma, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This court-martial was finally held last fall at Boston Army Base. I was represented by the ACLU, resulted in the dropping of all charges and specifications. This is just to point out to you that they will do that. I mean, they pursued me for sending that Christmas card taken from the Army Digest. They pursued me and spent, I guess, $1 million for 3 years across the country until they finally actually held a court-martial and it was thrown out. That's just to show that they do mean business.
Would you care to repeat Sherman's quotation? That's very good.
I'll give it to you after the testimony. We're beginning to run over. I'll be in the vets in the press room, as will all the other guys on the panel, after our thing here. Many people ask us, right, why we haven't spoken up before, and I think we have given you the reason, right? You're ordered to not to speak up. If you do speak up, action will be taken against you, sometimes very serious and very harsh action. There's another question in many people's minds here. They say, well, why do you talk now? You know, why do you come here and tell us these things that happened 2, 3, maybe 4, 5 years ago? You know, what's your motivation behind it? You want to get on the boob tube? You know, you're on some kind of an ego trip? You know, why are you here? I'm here speaking personally because I can't not be here. I'm here because, like, I have nightmares about things that happened to me and my friends. I'm here because my conscience will not let me forget what I want to forget. I didn't want to talk about it when I first got back. You know, I didn't want to talk about it at all. I didn't watch Cronkite. You know, I went fishing a lot and changed socks 2 or 3 times a day and slept on beds and ate cheeseburgers. But after a while, it gets to the point where you have to talk to somebody. And when I tried to talk to somebody, even my own parents, they didn't want to hear it. They didn't want to know. And that made me realize that no matter how painful it was for me, I had to tell them. I mean, they had to know. The fact that they didn't want to know told me they had to know. So I'm here, you know, not as a member of any political group, not as a member of any lobbying group. I'm just here as myself, you know, saying to other people, to other human beings, something that I just have to say, you know. And if you think it's just clearing my conscience or it's some kind of therapy, well, you can think what you want. But I gotta say it. I'm gonna ring off. I have one little thing I want to read. It's sort of a poem. It's not because I'm a real great poet that I want to read it, because I spent some time getting the fewest possible words to say what I thought I wanted to say. I was that tiny premature baby, born Christmas 1942 at St. Mary's Hospital. Remember how you all said I'd never make it? Then there was a time I read from the Bible. When the minister got sick just before his sermon, remember how you all said, hey, you ought to consider the ministry? How about the last second basket I made that beat Perryville, took us to the state tournament? Remember how you all cheered and said I'd make the pros someday? And when I was chosen the best actor in the college public speaking contest, remember how proud you were? You slapped my back and shook my hand. Then came basic training and advanced infantry training, an infantry officer's candidate school. Remember how impressed you all were that I became an officer? And then Vietnam, where I did my job. I got a Bronze Star and a Purple Heart and an honorable discharge. Remember how proud you were when I came home? But now, I ask why I had to shoot those little people. When I question the policies and the decisions and the people that made me a killer. When I ask you why, you never ask why. You treat me like a stranger. Hey, remember me? Thank you.
Can I make an addition to that? Like, I didn't know Larry here in Vietnam, but I met him in Chicago. We both got gassed together. A lot of us have been doing this for years. Larry has in his hands something I wrote in 67, just after I got out of the service. I was thrown out of Japan for things I was doing within it. We've been saying it for a long, long time, but only now, only in the last few months, have people started to listen. So it's not the matter of waiting so long to say, it's a matter of people waiting a hell of a long time to listen.
I just want to say, you know, like, I don't know where to even say... Be brief. I just want to say, you know, like, I don't know where to even state this because I haven't found an appropriate structure yet to relate to you in an appropriate fashion. I appreciate what you're doing here, and that means a great deal to me. However, you know, like, you use the term men and girls, and I wonder if you're aware of, you know, how that's dehumanizing me sitting here. I want, at some point, I think it's a valid thing to raise as, you know, somewhere there has to be an appropriate place to deal with this.
Madam Lady, we're quite aware of the fact that we're all chauvinists up here, but working hard on it, and we'd be happy to discuss it with you later or any other women in the room who do not like us calling you girls. There's a question over there.
Yes, Mr. Rockman. Do you have any testimony about the body count, the official MACV policy?
Yeah, I do.
Could you give it, please?
One of the things that I did as an information officer was at the end of each day, I turned in a thing called a SITREP, situation report. In this report, I gave sort of a rundown of the division's, the overall total division activities for the day, including the number of VC body count. Now, during my tour, there's a standing policy in MACV that VC losses for any given week for the entire campaign in Vietnam were not to fall below 2,000. Now, that it sometimes was kind of hard because if you reported negative contact for a day, in other words, there was no, you never saw an enemy and an enemy never saw you, it's kind of hard to come up with your daily allotment of bodies. I have been called back and ordered to dig up bodies. And I have asked units to dig up bodies, which they rightly interpreted as finding themselves a graveyard or someplace where they put some bodies before or someplace where they happen to know there were some bodies or some water buffaloes or some children or some elephants. Bodies are bodies, VC bodies are VC bodies, and we never fell below our quota. And my division was in a constant race. My division commander had a bet with the division commander of the 1st Infantry Division that during the first 3 months of 1968, that our body count would be higher than his body count. Now, it turned out that it was a tie, believe it or not. But our body count was higher than his body count if you count number of GIs killed. Well, and anybody here on the panel can talk about that body count businesses.
Question here.
During the past 2 days, we've heard several testimonies to the effect of increasing the body count and digging up graves. Why is it necessary, why was it felt necessary to go through the actual effort of digging up graves? Why was not simply the number increased? I mean, why, when you dig up graves, everybody knew the hoax involved. Why could it not just simply be done by word?
It was done in both fashions.
You know? In one actual instance that I was in on where we had a body count of 17 and it was a matter of digging up graves, the idea was to dig up a grave and verify that this particular Vietnamese had been killed in that action and had been hastily buried as the Viet Cong left. But what we actually did was dug in one grave that looked very old in this case. It was just an old graveyard. The fellows digging got tired of digging, so we didn't even get down to any skeleton, but we counted all the graves in the old graveyard. So as far as the report that went to division headquarters, we had uncovered graves that were new.
I'd like to ask a question in regard to if the black GIs in Vietnam were treated, received the harassment that the white GIs received when they were trying to marry Vietnamese girls, and also the type of treatment that the black GIs got in regard to the racial tension between the white GIs and blacks in Vietnam.
I was kicked out of Japan for this. The marriage of Asian girls, it was equal for black or white. You got the same harassment. A black man might have gotten a hell of a lot more harassment, but that was probably essentially because he was black and had to have his portion of harassment to the fact of he was going to marry an Asian girl. Woman. Actually, the one I was going to marry was a girl. She was 17, U.S., 18 Vietnamese. But in Japan, during the time of, you're all familiar with it, during the time of the Detroit uprising in the summer of 67, I was in Japan. Now, overseas, blacks and whites segregate themselves into different sections of town. They have their own, each has its own little entertainment area, and there's a line, and neither crosses each of those lines. Iwakuni had the same thing. Because of Detroit and the tensions of the summer stateside, most of the blacks and whites on the base at Iwakuni believed it was inevitable that it was going to explode there. And I went and talked to a hell of a lot of people. I was the base editor of the newspaper. And I talked to both blacks and whites, about, I don't know how many, maybe 200, I'm not sure. And I wrote an editorial, which the colonel gave me direct orders not to publish, which I did publish anyway, which amounted in 10 MPs taking me to an airplane. However, what I understand is that helped quell the, what was going to happen, because my premise was that no matter what was going to happen between the blacks and the whites, the Japanese in the country were going to be the ones who suffered the most. They were going to be caught in the crossfire. And so I rather angrily pointed that out. And from what I gather, there was no riot. From what I gather from the mail and letters I got, that it just by the very fact that people believe something to be inevitable and you point it out to them that the only inevitability is their belief in it, it seemed to calm things down. I don't know about the racial tension in Iwakuni right now, but I'm willing to bet it's essentially the same. Riding on an airplane here, I talked with a little woman Marine, PFC, and she was telling me about Pendleton. She was telling me how hot it is at Pendleton racially. That blacks and whites, no one walks alone on that base. They walk in packs, blacks and whites. The tension is so high, it's ready to explode. So, you can take it from there.
Any of you can answer this question, I guess. What was the attitude towards the civilians, the people in the United States who were getting this misleading information about the state of the war? Did you feel contempt for them being so stupid and believing it, or what?
At that time, it was a rather frustrating experience. It was, you just couldn't fight Reader's Digest. The people read it and believed it.
I felt angry at the press, at the civilian press, for not sending out reporters who would really go after the facts. It seemed that the civilian reporters were very docile and would accept what the Army told them. I was angry, and I still am. I don't think the war has been reported accurately.
This guy, I want to say one thing, okay? This thing still continues. I mean, because maybe most of us in this room have an understanding of it. The lady, like, who runs the cigar stand downstairs, you know, any of you who've encountered her, she all she knows about what's going on up here, although it's pretty big for her, I guess, is that what she read in the Detroit News, which said that, no, I'm just telling you what she told me, which said that we were alleged veterans, you know, and that we, you know, We were just phonies. And she's like where it's at, I think, to a large majority of this country, because she said, look, I don't want to listen to you because you're a commie. I said, how do you know? She said, I read it in the news. That's what she told me.
I think it's quite apparent to most people in here how the military information service has distorted the news. However, some pretty serious indictments about the civilian press have been made today, and I would like to ask if any of the gentlemen of the press or ladies of the press sitting in the front would dare or care to respond to these charges of the prostitution of your profession.
Right. Hey, I was in Vietnam as a civilian reporter, and I'd like to know if I can testify to some of the reasons why the civilian press has been bought up.
Sure.
I'm asking you.
You have white shirt.
Come on up.
I don't have a question. I have some testimony to give. I was in the civilian press. I will, man. My name is Lee Elbinger, and I was in Vietnam for the month of December of 1967. I was representing Michigan State University News, and I had accreditation with MACV. Now, I would like to explain something about what it was like to be a civilian reporter in Vietnam. I would like to corroborate with much of what these gentlemen have said and to elaborate upon it. I noticed one thing about when I first got to Vietnam as a reporter, I noticed that the first thing the Army tried to do was to buy you off. And I got a little list of things that they do to buy you off. First, they take you into JustPow and they give you a briefing and a big manual about what you're supposed to do, etc., as a reporter. Now, if you're a reporter from the United States, or if you have ARVN accreditation, which I also had, which allowed me to go to the ARVN press briefings, you're treated better than the third country nationals. The third country nationals are anyone in that country who's not United States or Vietnamese, and they don't get these privileges. The privileges, some of the privileges are access to the officers' open mess in Saigon on top of the Rex Hotel. Let me tell you a little bit what it's like to go up to the officers' open mess up there, and this is where all the reporters sit around and get drunk with all the officers. There's 20 slot machines up there. There's a swimming pool. There's a bar and a rock band which goes continually. And every Sunday night they have a $2 steak dinner where while the people in the streets are starving, these people are up there just swimming around and getting drunk and having and eating steak. Now when I got there, I was told that I could send and receive mail with postage rights from APO San Francisco, which I never did because I didn't really trust them. I was given PX rights. I was allowed to go into the PX and buy any item up to the value of $10. I was given my MACV press accreditation allowed me to fly free on any military airplanes, and we could bump off up to 15 GIs. In other words, the press had priority. It came right after the officers, I guess. I was given a beer ration card, a liquor ration card, and a tobacco ration card, which could be used at the PX, none of which I ever used. The reason the reporters never left Saigon was because Saigon was the only place in the country that was really very much like America, and it was very comfortable just to sit there and to go to the 4:15 every day at JustPow. They had these press conferences at 4:15, which, yeah, we called them the 4:15 follies, and. A friend of mine, a Danish correspondent, told me that a Swedish television crew came one day, filmed the entire 45-minute press conference, and showed it on Swedish television as a comedy. I did take advantage of my free flights around the country. I got to Nha Trang, I got to Da Nang, and I was in Hue 1 month before it was destroyed. In the press camps, I was in the press camp in Nha Trang and Da Nang. And you were allowed to stay there for $3 a night. It had a bar and it had hot showers in it, which was you know, really beautiful compared to what the men were getting there. And you were supplied with an interpreter and a chauffeured Jeep. But I had a little bit of trouble because every time I got in there and they started finding out what I was doing, and in this case, when I went to Nha Trang twice,
to investigate the murder of a special forces captain who murdered his interpreter. And as soon as they got out there and they started finding out what I was doing, suddenly a lot of those privileges which I was supposed to have were mysteriously cut off. When I got out to the, you know, speaking on, this, on the issue of censorship, when I got out to the special forces camp outside of Nha Trang, I think it was the 5th Special Forces, is that correct? I got out there and I had a tape recorder with me, and I had a whole list of questions from some people in Saigon. The father of this interpreter, whose son was killed, he was given half a helicopter ride, as they call it. In Vietnam, he was killed by his captain because, well, apparently there was a squabble. Somebody said he was stealing something. But the point of it is, I wanted to interview one of the key witnesses who I was told both in Nha Trang and in Saigon could speak English. And I got to the Special Forces camp, and when they found out that I wanted to talk to this man, I knew he was there because they said that he was there. They would not allow me to speak to him. They told me he was a truck driver, he didn't speak English, and I didn't want to see him. What they did instead was they piled me into a Jeep and they took me over to this place where they were displaying all these dead bodies. And I was told that these were VC that had been shot the night before. There were two rows of five each of the dead bodies of some Vietnamese people, young girls, old men, and young men as well. And I was told that it was official policy, not of our government, I suppose, but of the Arvin forces, to line these bodies up and leave them there for one full day so that they could, I guess it had a psychological effect of terrorizing the villagers. To keep it very brief, I just want to say one more thing about reporting in Vietnam. When I got over there, I was very keen on being objective. I tried very hard to keep emotionalism out of what I was doing. I admitted in all the things that I wrote that I was prejudiced against the war, and I tried to have that discounted by just trying to get the facts. Then I was reading Franz Fanon's book, Wretched of the Earth, where he talked about colonial wars, and he talked about imperialism, and that when a newspaper reporter says, I'm just being objective, I'm just reporting the facts, in effect he is fighting on the side of the imperialists. So it's a very difficult thing if you're a newspaper reporter and you're trying to just be objective and to be coldly unemotional and not to get involved as a human being, chances are you're not telling the full story, because the full story, and I think healthy people have emotions, I finally just had to discard this whole policy of objectivity, and I said at the beginning of all my reports, this is a subjective impression. I started giving just surrealistic subjective impressions, and I felt that was the best way to report on this atrocity. Thank you.
One point to add to that: every week in our office, and posted to all the GI correspondents, would be a list of civilian reporters whose accreditations were ripped off for one reason or another. And generally, anybody that ever reported on anything significant in Vietnam had his accreditation taken away from him.
Right. An instance of that just, you know, rings a bell in my head. I have here a story written by Merton Perry, who was the Saigon bureau chief of Newsweek magazine. It was written in 1967. It's called Their Lions, Our Rabbits. It's an expose of the Vietnamization program. It appeared in Newsweek magazine. Merton Perry had his credentials ripped off, was suspended for a short time, I believe, by his headquarters in New York City, I believe. All issues of that magazine, of Newsweek, were confiscated in Vietnam, including the issues in the PXs around the American bases. So that's just a specific example of there. Look, don't get us wrong. There were some really great civilian reporters. Don Webster comes to mind in my experiences. Merton Perry. Who's the guy from
AP? Peter Arnett.
Peter Arnett. A lot of names come to mind. We began to sense after a while, of course, you know, who the guys were really straight. And they would frequently
one of the reasons you did get some of the things that we mentioned that never were talked about, shotguns, et cetera, is that they would sort of in-run the information offices, either with our cooperation or our without our cooperation, and sort of go straight to the field and get the stories. Now, some of the press, let me emphasize, some of the press, you know, I mean, many were killed, really, doing really great jobs, but we did have a very big problem with apathetic press. I might mention Just Pal Joe Freed from the New York Daily News, who never left the Caravelle Hotel in Saigon, who writes the most fantastic I Was There battle stories you'll ever want to know.
I'd like to add one last point about press censorship. After my 3 years in the Army, when I got out in 65, having resigned a West Point appointment that I got in Vietnam in 63, I went to work for a newspaper in this country to try to find out why what I had seen going on in Vietnam wasn't being reported here, because I knew there were some good reporters over there. So I worked for a major newspaper, which I will not name, because it could be any newspaper in this country. Those stories that came in that were best, that were good, were killed by the editors here who knew more about Vietnam than those of us who had been there. Not only did they kill these stories when little things came about what Johnson was supposedly doing, going out to Asia, having meetings with Key, they would stick little headlines on a story that mentioned nothing about peace talks that would say, Johnson in peace parley in the Philippines.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to say that yesterday, I was listening to a CBS news photographer who was sitting
WBA
up here, I don't see anymore. He was sitting up here a little while ago. He said that this stuff isn't anything new, that we've been photographing this all along, right from the beginning. And, you know, I'm just wondering, you know, why the hell it wasn't on TV. Also, I'd like to know, like, I guess apparently all of you people can be prosecuted and imprisoned and I don't know what else, testimony you've been giving. I'd like to know, like who's making these laws and how they're enforced, who executes them, and that kind of thing.
There's two questions. One was, the gentleman said he saw a CBS News crew and he talked with them briefly, and he heard them. Okay, he heard somebody on the crew say that it was old stuff and that they'd seen it before and they'd filmed it before. And his question was, why wasn't it on TV? The second question was, are we liable for prosecution for our testimony? And if we are indeed liable, whom are we liable to? Is that essentially the question? Some of us are liable. Those of us who have signed, those of us who had secret clearances or above, who have signed some kind of release, not release form, are liable, and we're liable to the Army, and the Army is liable to itself. The Army represents the government that we elected, if that answers your question. The other question is, why isn't it on CBS News, and why wasn't it on last night, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I can only say two things. One is sort of what Jan said about self-censorship within the network, which is a big problem. And the other problem is there's a thing called that people in the press and the media have for this kind of situation. The term is called market fatigue. Is there anybody on the panel want to add to that? Any other questions from anybody in the audience?
I'd like to ask, what did the CIA do with Vietnam to rail some
kind of the I'm sorry, what was the question? We have to beat it much louder than that.
I want to know what the CIA has done in Vietnam.
What the CIA has done in Vietnam? What haven't they done? all over the
Cambodia.
Country.
They did a pretty good job there.
Take a look at Laos now.
I think that pretty well answers it.
That's a whole nother
take a look at your own anti-war movement.
And you'll find the CIA in it somewhere.
Right.
The CIA in Asia has almost total control over the activities of many parts of the special forces and all the clandestine mercenary groups. The extent of that control is very been documented quite a bit and is readily available. None of us have been CIA agents, obviously, so we can't speak from experience other than just encountering them from time to time. Yes, sir, you had a question?
You were talking about how you occasionally red lines some stuff that couldn't be reported. Well, you know, just recently we've been hearing about the drug problem in Vietnam. Has this slipped out or has they been getting a little bit more lean?
The drug problem, was broken by CBS News, if you remember correctly, not by the military. CBS ran that little thing which shows the guys, puffing up with the barrel of the shotgun. The shotgun itself was sort of an interesting thing since it's not supposed to be shown, especially not in that context.
I'm sorry, we are going to have to close this panel now so the next panel can begin. I would like to read a telegram that has arrived this morning as active...